Je passe donc maintenant la parole pour un premier commentaire d'ensemble à Nathaniel Berman. Peut-être une petite précision à cet égard-là. Je vous parlais de diversité en ce qui concerne les intervenants tout à l'heure. Vous l'avez vu sur le fond avec les exposés que nous venons d'entendre. Vous le verrez aussi sur la forme maintenant, puisque Nathaniel va intervenir en anglais, mais il sera tout disposé à prendre vos questions en français tout à l'heure, si vous le souhaitez. Donc je lui passe la parole.
Thank you. And I apologize in advance for speaking in English. My role on this panel is to be a commentator, and so I'm sort of making it up as we go along, and that's a little bit harder for me in French than if I prepared in advance. But I'm happy to repeat anything in French or any other language that you'd like. Pierre Klein started off our conference by telling us that we should both the panelists and the audience should limit ourselves to l'actualité, to current questions, and specifically to current legal questions. And he repeated this warning a number of times. You don't have to be Sigmund Freud to know that when somebody says, repeats and repeats, that there must be something, some desire that is being limited, okay? And what is being limited? Well, what's being limited, of course, in the case of the Israel-Palestine debate is that there are very few people left in the universe, whether on our planet or other planets, who don't have a very strong view about this conflict. I mean, if I would say to you, how many people here in this room are neutral on the question and are ready to deal with it as a neutral question of law, anyone who raises their hand needs to go see someone about the morality of telling the truth. So what we're really dealing with here is a certain kind of discipline, disciplining ourselves, disciplining our emotions, disciplining ourselves as human beings to limit ourselves to certain kinds of questions. Now, the word discipline has two meanings, I think, in French and in English. It can mean the way you control something, right? I'm disciplining myself to, But it also can mean a specialty, an academic specialty, right? So we have to discipline ourselves in order to be fully part of the discipline of international law. And indeed, the Palestine question is somehow linked to the fate of international law and always has been. The Palestine question has been on the international agenda, probably for a few thousand years, but in its recognizably modern form, at least since 1917, in a recognizably modern international legal form, and certainly as of the formulation of the League of Nations mandate. Now, it is also very significant that our panel is about the state. Since the question of Palestine is linked to the fate of international law, we also know, those of us in the discipline, that the question of the state has always been central to the question of the discipline of international law. International law has a fetish for the state, and that fetish can either be worshiping the state, but as you might know about fetishism, fetishes are also sometimes beaten, right? People often have an ambivalent relationship to their fetish, and again, you don't have to be Sigmund Freud to know that. They're loved, they're beaten, people carry around little things with them, and they do all kinds of stuff with it. And international lawyers are the same with the state. The international lawyers, we all worship the state, and we all love to snuggle up to statesmen and to advise kings and presidents and prime ministers, and international lawyers tend to brag about that kind of stuff. But we also think of ourselves as, of course, we're not merely servants of the state, we're the conscience of humanity, and we would never soil our hands with being implicated with power, even though the next day we're flying off to Washington or Brussels or New York to advise power. So when we ask, for example, Professor Fortot asked, is it the role of international law to determine statehood? Well, international law has been obsessed with statehood from the beginning, As I say, the role of the state has also something to do with the status of international law and the different conceptions of international law. I want to quote something from a treatise of which Professor Fortot is one of the co-authors, Droit International Public, about why there are these criteria for statehood. I mean, why can't you just recognize anything as a state? This room, Brussels, whatever. Maybe Brussels will be a state someday. why are there technical criteria? And we can argue about whether Palestine meets them. Well, here's a quote, and I think this quote is excellent. I don't know if you wrote it or one of your co-authors. But there's a strict definition of state, and this is in French. Why? Because that definition a pour ambition première d'isoler ce phénomène et cette institution juridique, d'autres entités jouent un rôle dans les relations internationales. Okay, but why? Because l'État doit rester un sujet de droit suffisamment puissant et rare pour prétendre conserver une place privilégiée dans la conduite des relations internationales. Okay, so in other words, there's a strict definition of statehood. Why? In order to keep the state in its role, in its privileged role. It's kind of like being a lawyer. In many countries, in many jurisdictions, the number of lawyers who can pass the examination to become a lawyer, it's limited, not by how well people do on the exam, but there's an actually absolute number. And there's only one reason for it, so that lawyers can make money. There's no other reason. If you have too many lawyers, then the lawyers make less money. If they're more rare, they make more money. There's no other reason for keeping an absolute number rather than having it has to do with a performance on the exam. So it's similar here. The reason why the criteria have to be strict is so that states can have power. The more states there are, the less power. States have less power today than they did 100 years ago when there were far fewer states. States that had more power, there were only a few states. There was France, people know about France. It controlled half the world. Britain controlled the other half. The United States controlled the third half. Okay. So here's my point. The serious point here is, right, if we're arguing about these criteria, right, we have to remember something. This is not a neutral discourse, right? In other words, the seemingly technical fact of strict technical criteria for statehood is not neutral. It comes from a particular conception of international society in which statehood has a privileged role. That's why there are these technical criteria, okay? So it's not a neutral thing, it's a particular conception of how things should work. Now, why do the Palestinians want a state? Well, I just said, because international statesmen and lawyers have created the situation in which if you want to have power in the world, you have to have a state, right? Okay, why do the Zionists want a state? Presumably for the same reason, okay? Now, there are all sorts of reasons, all sorts of things you get out of being a state. You get recognition, you get to sit in the UN, you can get military help, obviously not a side question here. Now, Professor Fortot and other speakers pointed us toward this question of whether Palestine can have standing before the International Criminal Court, and they pointed us toward the functionalist definition of a state or a relativist idea of a state, right? So you disaggregate, either you disaggregate the state into its functions, it has many functions, it collects the garbage, it provides electricity, it goes to the International Criminal Court, it has an army, it opens a museum, it has a flag, it composes a national anthem, lots of functions, right? And a thing can be a state for some of the functions and not for others of the functions. And so that's part of the argument for giving Palestine standing before the International Criminal Court, okay? So for this function, it is a state. For other functions, it's not a state, whatever. And so that's a fine legal argument, and it's fine by me. But I just want to remind us that is this really what's at stake? Is this really why we're debating the question of Palestinian statehood, right? In other words, isn't one of the main critiques of the Oslo Accords, right, promulgated by many people, right, one of the main critiques of those accords was precisely that it didn't give Palestinians full statehood, that it was a functionalist a delegation of certain powers to the Palestinian state, municipal powers, certain powers about local government. other words, that was precisely one of the critiques of it, was that it was based on this functionalist idea of the state. Okay? Now, it's true that an approach might be, you know, good for the Palestinians in one zone and bad for them in another zone. They might want to be absolutist about statehood here and relativist about statehood there. But again, I just want to point you to this fact that that's not, the functionalist thing is not what's really at stake. It might be a lawyer's question, but I don't think that's fully the reason why there are 300 people in this room, is to debate the lawyer's questions. In fact, the Oslo Accord is one of the main arguments against giving Palestine standing before the International Criminal Court, that they don't have full criminal jurisdiction over territories in the West Bank and Gaza, right? That is actually one of the main technical arguments given against standing, is this functionalist, the use of the functionalist disaggregation of state powers that are embodied in the Oslo Accords turns out to be one of the arguments against standing, but also the functionalist approach is one of the arguments for standing. Say they can have statehood here in the International Criminal Court, but not elsewhere. Okay. Our attention has also been drawn in this forum to the fact that this question of Palestinian statehood has been perpetually deferred, for example, in relation to the Geneva Conventions and the protocols, and now it's been deferred for whatever 2 years by the International Criminal Court. Now, the deferral is itself symptomatic. In other words, it's not just these guys are too lazy, they don't know how to take a stand, they're cowards, but no, the deferral of the question is itself plays an important role in international law. Okay? And I think that Marcelo Cohen, when he says the Palestinians should, you know, sortir de l'ambiguïté, right? He's calling basically anything as a position. They should leave their ambiguous state, right? That's a particular position within international law. In other words, their ambiguous state is not a privation. It's not a negative status. It's an affirmative status created by international law. Okay, it's the status of peoples with self-determination rights that are in this kind of special status, and what a judge on the International Court in 1950 called sovereignty in abeyance, right? The suspension of sovereignty. This territory, sovereignty doesn't apply to this territory. It's in abeyance. It's in suspension. That's an affirmative condition created by international law for various reasons. So what I'm saying here is that it's not that their status is undetermined by international law, and therefore they should declare statehood in order to have a full status in international law. No, actually, their current status is a status created by international law. International law is a player in this action. It's not a neutral observer, it's a player. It's created their status, if you're following me, right? So the point, international is not a neutral observer evaluating the facts down there, right? It's actually created those facts down there. Okay, why are we having this legal debate? And why is the question of Palestine such a juridified question, right? Is it really different than the political debate, right? Well, it has something to do with discipline, it has something to do with all that, being able to talk civilly to each other. People talk more civilly when they talk about law than when they talk about politics. But is it actually substantially different than a political debate here? I don't want to answer that question. Rather, I want to return and maybe... Okay.
Less than five.
Okay. So I want to conclude then by returning really to my point of departure and open up this question about international law and how international law has always been bound up with the question of Palestine. And it goes like this, and I'm going to conclude with this. International law has been around for some time in various forms, say from 1648 or from whenever. It doesn't matter exactly when it started, but it's been around for a couple hundred years at least. And a lot has happened during those couple of hundred years. Some people might know that in the 19th century, the main preoccupation of international law, or one of its main preoccupations, was the facilitation of colonialism. How to facilitate colonialism, how to divide up Africa so that the British and the French and the Germans won't have wars with each other, but will do it peacefully. It was one of its main goals was the facilitation of colonialism, and you can verify that by taking out a treatise of international law from the 19th century, and you'll see what percentage of it is really dealing with the facilitation of colonialism. We don't think of that today. Today we think of international law as facilitating anti-colonialism or decolonization or managing the post-colonial process. That's a pretty new thing for international law. International law, like other features of human society, of human culture, nothing gets actually kicked out of international law. Everything sort of stays there, and it sort of accretes, right? Like a geological formation, or like the unconscious, things don't disappear. They're sort of all there, right? The legal arguments about the question of Palestine and Israel, part of the reason that they go on interminably is that different authors or different lawyers draw on different dimensions of international law. So some of them draw on those maybe older dimensions of international law, which were more favorable to colonialism. Others draw on more of the anti-colonial heritage. Some draw on the human rights heritage, and so forth. And the interpretation of the various documents is itself, it's the technical legal debates about the meaning of various documents really reflect broader debates about what international law is all about. Let me give a very simple example. The question is, in the functionalist approach here, they say, well, maybe Palestine should have standing before the International Criminal Court. Why? Because the purpose of the International Criminal Court is to punish international criminals, right? It's not really concerned with the question of statehood. That's not really its job. It was set up for the purpose of punishing international criminals. And if there are international criminals involved, for example, in the invasion of Gaza in 2009, then everything should be done, all the legal documents should be interpreted in such a way as to facilitate jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. That's one of the key arguments, I'd say perhaps the main argument, I think, for the standing of Palestine before the International Criminal Court. It has to do with the function. What is the main telos of the statute of Rome and of the court as a whole, right? That's one of the main arguments, okay? Now, the counter-argument is, right, that the telos of the International Criminal Court is not to punish international criminals, but rather to punish international criminals within the legal framework set up by the court, which, like most documents in international law, still retains a very strong state-centric center of gravity, right? Now, how are you going to choose between these two positions? They are both, the text won't tell you the answer, right? The only way you're going to know the answer to that question is your own fundamental broad view about what international law is about, and that applies to the Statute of Rome just as it applies to the UN Charter, just as it applies to the Geneva Conventions, just as it applies to everything. You're not going to solve this as a technical legal matter. You're going to take the position that you take because of your broader approach to interpreting international legal documents. This is also true for how to interpret the Oslo Accords. There are the same sorts of things. There is kind of a somewhat eccentric position in this debate about the International Criminal Court by John Quigley, who says, actually, Palestine has been a state since the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, okay? And it's just sort of been dormant, but any time it can assert itself, that should be done, right? And it's a very, very interesting argument, and very bold, and it's really a minority position, but it's very bold and very interesting and all that. Of course, it ignores a key document, which is the League of Nations mandate over Palestine, which explicitly called for the administration of Palestine with a view to establishing a national home for the Jewish people. Now, why does Quigley ignore it? Well, presumably he ignores it because the League of Nations mandate could be perceived as an artifact of colonialism, and therefore, since we're in an anti-colonial era since, say, 1960 or thereabouts, it should be not read, right? In other words, it's a selective reading of international legal history, right? Those who oppose that say, no, you have to read the whole history, you have to take the whole thing into account. And again, there's no way to decide between these two approaches to reading the text other than a real decision about your broader conception of what international law is about. And that question itself, although it's a broad theoretical question, has as a matter of history, and I'll conclude with this, has as a matter of history over the last 100 years been intimately bound up with certain big questions, big specific conflicts in international law, and en première place, the question of Palestine. Thank you.
Bien, merci beaucoup.